This week on Pirate Party Radio, Canada's version of DMCA, DRM emerges as Copyright Modernization Act, massive copyright violator database proposed in the UK, and facial biometrics of all citizens being compiled in Australia. This is Pirate Party Radio, episode 31 for Thursday, June 3rd, 2010.
Now the reason for this, the reason that the fashion industry doesn't have any copyright protection is because the courts decided long ago that apparel is too utilitarian to qualify for copyright protection. They didn't want a handful of designers owning the seminal building blocks of our clothing. And then everybody else would have to license this cuff or this sleeve because Joe Blow owns it. Because there's no copyright protection in this industry, there's a very open and creative ecology of creativity. Unlike their creative brothers and sisters who are sculptors or photographers or filmmakers or musicians, fashion designers can sample from all their peers' designs. They can take any element from any garment from the history of fashion and incorporate it into their own design.
The act is needed because, quite candidly, we're in the midst of a worldwide epidemic of copyright piracy. And so I'm clear, I'm not just talking about teenagers downloading songs, though that's a serious problem in the aggregate. I'm talking about commercial enterprises engaged in massive for-profit piracy. I'm talking about organized crime syndicates, and there's every reason to believe, in some places, terrorist organizations funding themselves, at least in part, through copyright piracy.
We are under siege. They are doing everything they can to prevent progress, to prevent the spread of culture, and to prevent privacy as we know it. The only way to stop this is to unite. This is definitely a global movement. It's continuing to spread across the world like wildfire. We are seeing the birth of a new global political power. There's no way to control the information. There's no way to control culture, control knowledge. And those who control culture and knowledge control the world. And that is losing its last control points. People don't understand how big this really is.
I'm James O'Brien, and welcome to Pirate Party Radio, the official show of the Pirate Party of Canada and the U.S., your source for news around the world on copyright, net neutrality, open government, free culture and speech, patents, privacy, and more. And make sure you check out the Pirate Party Radio forums for the links to all the news stories I mentioned during the show. We've got a couple of intro clips off the top. The first one was from Joanna Blakely, Lessons from Fashion's Free Culture, that was sent in by DC. And another listener commented on the same clip, this great video, which is okay to download, it was a TED Talk actually, gives a detailed picture of what the world would be like without copyright and patent protection. The fashion industry is already living in that world. It hasn't stopped people from wearing clothes or spending ridiculous amounts of money for high fashion, even when a virtually identical knockoff is quickly made available. I now think that the fashion industry is a good example to use when people claim that we can't live without these protections, and it is a good example to point to for the lack of copyright protection and how an industry flourishes without this copyright protection in place, and how innovation still happens within it, and it doesn't just completely shut down. U.S. Copyright Office official pretends that concerns about ACT are unfounded, mocks legitimate concerns. That was the second clip. It was sent in by Weird Wolf. He says, here's a link I think you will really love. It's got an 80-minute video discussing about the U.S. Trade Representative, the American Electronics Association, ACTA, and some other things. Plus, there's a nice and long commentary with the video. It talks a little bit about the video below it. So there's a couple of links to go watch and get some media into you about ACTA and copyright. Got some incoming messages, some questions from some listeners. A listener, Christopher, writes, Is it legal to download a digital copy, AVI, etc., of a movie you legally purchased? And he says he's coming from the U.S., as a U.S. perspective. Here's a hypothetical situation. I buy movie X and would like to keep the physical media in good shape. So I download a copy of the movie and promptly get sued by the copyright owner. According to the law, are my actions legal? According to the terms of fair use, or so I understand, it's legal to make a copy of a legally purchased movie as a backup. However, the DMCA states that you're not allowed to bypass any encryption methods put in place by the manufacturer. Since I cannot make my fair use copy, is it legal to obtain my content from, say, a peer-to-peer network? I've been wondering this for a while, and every time I look into it online, all I find are guesses and theories. It also seems like a very important question regarding the ongoing torrent search engine lawsuits, as it could be then be stated that not all instances of a downloaded of a copyright work can be construed as an instance of copyright infringement. That's a very good question. Because he's downloading from another source, and it's legal to have a backup of his DVD, but he's not able to make a backup of his DVD because he would circumvent the DMCA. So, no, it's probably not legal because of the DMCA. The person who made the copy that put it on the internet had to circumvent encryption to obtain it. Because if they're making a copy from the exact same DVD that you're getting a copy from, then they would have to break it. It's possibly a little bit more legal if they copied it off of a videotape, like a VHS tape. But even then, they probably have to defeat Macrovision, which may or may not count under DMCA because it's analog and not digital protection of the copyrighted work. The problem all comes down to DMCA, which pretty much closes any legal loophole that existed before, which is the whole point of the DMCA. And the FCC recently granted Hollywood the right to shut off the analog outputs on our media devices, and thereby closing the analog hole they've been going after for so long. It was the last key to the puzzle of completely making unauthorized media transfer illegal unless they give the say-so. The same lockdowns are coming to Canada, as you'll hear in some stories coming up. So really, it's about control. Originally, yes, you could make copies for your personal use. But as time goes on and things become more and more digital, they are putting in place kind of closing these loopholes, as they see them as loopholes, so that you can't even make copies of your own movies that are supposedly legal to back up because of DMCA, and that is really what they keep relying upon. And as soon as they put some sort of lock on it, some sort of thing that you have to apply a measure to decrypt, say, like CSS for DVDs, or even newer encryption methods for Blu-ray that have to phone home and get a key to unlock the movie so you can play it. They apply these locks on them, these artificial locks, so that they can point the finger and say, you broke the lock. Therefore, you broke the law under DMCA because you broke our encryption. Now, before this, there was VHS, and there was no digital locks on it. There's CDs, there's no digital locks on those as well. But as soon as you apply a lock, say, even this, the most innocent lock, say, of Rot 13, of simply changing one character for another character, or one bit for another bit, say you reversed all the bits on a DVD, ones for zeros, so that it didn't decrypt without actually changing all the ones to zeros, that would essentially be a digital lock on your data, and would be going against what is put in the DMCA. Like, if I put this radio show out, and you press play on it, and it's a WAV file or an MP3, and you press play, and it would come back as all static, and you wouldn't be able to hear it, because I've reversed the ones and zeros, and then I distribute with it a player that would decrypt it on the fly and change the one to zeros and zeros to ones, and then I would be applying a lock. And if you reverse that, like use some other decryption program, as simple as it is, it doesn't matter how simple or how hard it is, you would be circumventing the DMCA, and I could go after you under law for, you know, decrypting something without me giving the say-so with my special decryption program that I would sell for $10,000 and license it for $10,000 to other people who wish to make their own player. And it goes on and on from there. So, no, it's probably not legal because somebody else had to make a copy. So maybe if you found a VHS copy, and even then, you would have to make up the backup copy. You can't obtain it from somebody else who would be charged under distribution, blah, blah, blah. So no, in the short and probably long, no, it's not legal. Sorry to say that under current law, but we must show them the error of their ways and how silly these laws are by giving examples that it used to be legal and now it's not legal just because they put a little bit saying, no, you can't because I say you can't. And that's all the DMCA is. It doesn't matter that it's a lock or encryption. It's a bit. It's a little lock that's saying, no, you can't because I say you can't. Even for the most innocent things of backing up your DVD in case it gets scratched, which is a major concern for a lot of people because media does not last forever. You could go to old CDs that you may burn copies of, or even old CDs, and you look at the bottom of them, they're all scratched and horrible, and try and put it in, it skips. But if you made a backup of that in perfect digital copy, then you would be able to play it and make another copy of it, and you've still given the money to the original content owner, and nobody would be losing out. And you'd still be able to enjoy the media, but that is not the game they want to play. The next letter comes from Deset, and they write, what do you think of the name of the Pirate Party? Do you think using the word pirate makes a presupposition of various attitudes of pirates onto the party that aren't actual party view, such as pillaging and assaulting villages while looking for gold bullion, or the fact of the nature of the party are all criminals in nature? The reason why I ask this isn't because I think these things, but I hear it in everyone that I talk to about the Pirate Party. How they think it's either a joke, or that it's not a real party, or even that it's a political party made of criminals. It makes me very upset because I see hope for our internet rights, open government, and patent reform through this party, but most people see it as just a name that sounds like it isn't taking itself seriously. Thanks again for your comments. Well, I don't think this is the case with the name of the Pirate Party. And there are already elected members in the EU Parliament under the name of the Pirate Party. It is a very serious political movement that has already gained ground around the world. I think the name is actually an asset to the party as it attracts attention to the problems that the party stands for by people even asking the question, why do you call yourself the Pirate Party? It spurs on conversation and discussion about the issues that would not be heard if it was called by another name that doesn't stand out amongst the dozens of non-memorable parties. Of mixing and matching all these different words that really are vague and have distorted over time, why not pick something that is more memorable, stands out, and makes people ask you, why? Why did you pick Pirate Party? And then you've got their attention. Then you can talk to them about the things that matter. The major thing is getting people's attention. If nobody cares about you, nobody's going to listen to you. And once you get people coming up to you, as you have people coming up to you saying that, oh, it's a joke, or that's a crazy name for a party, but they're talking to you about the Pirate Party, and then you can tell them about what it stands for. And if they're dismissing a whole ideology and a whole set of things that are important to people by dismissing it just because of the name, then that is a little bit petty. And I think that's what you're scared of, but I don't think that's the case. I think it's the same as the name of bands. I can relate this to band names, because at first when you hear the names of some weird named bands like the Red Hot Chili Peppers or Rage Against the Machine, to you right now, those names seem like, oh yeah, Rage Against the Machine, Red Hot Chili Peppers. But the first time you heard them, you'd be like, Red Hot Chili Peppers? That's the name of a band? That's the name that they chose to go on stage and say, we are Red Hot Chili Peppers? But now, it doesn't matter. You say the name enough times, it becomes secondary to the music that they're playing on stage. And the name, the Pirate Party, becomes second to the important issues it stands for as well. the name will fade away and people will see and recognize, oh, the Pirate Party. To me, it doesn't ring anything about, you know, eye patches and people sailing ships and looting gold. It doesn't stand to me for that at all anymore. And it will, the name will fade away, and all of the issues will stand there, just as the name will become less important as Red Hot Chili Peppers is to the actual music that they play. If you'd like to contact me or ask a question or leave a comment, head over to the Pirate Party Radio site at piratepartyradio.com and fill out the feedback form. Big news! In Canada, where I live, copyright news from Canada. The Government of Canada introduces proposals to modernize the Copyright Act. And this is taken right off the government's website. The Honorable Tony Clement, Minister of Industry, and the Honorable James Moore, Minister of Canada Heritage and Official Languages, today announced the introduction of legislation to modernize the Copyright Act. The legislation is a key pillar in the government's commitment in the 2010 speech from the throne to position Canada as a leader in the global digital economy. Our government promised to introduce legislation that will modernize Canadian copyright law for the digital age while protecting and creating jobs, promoting innovation, and attracting new investment to Canada, said Minister Clement. The legislation will ensure that Canada's copyright laws are forward-looking and responsive in a fast-paced digital world. Today, we're introducing a copyright bill that offers a common-sense balance between the interests of consumers and the rights of the creative community, said Minister Moore. The bill is flexible, reflects the changing behaviors of consumers, Freudian slip there, and the evolution of technology, and responds to what we have heard in the consultations. The popularity of Web 2.0, social media, and new technologies such as the MP3 player and digital books have changed the way Canadians create and make use of copyrighted material. This bill recognizes the many new ways in which teachers, students, artists, software companies, consumers, families, copyright owners, and many others use the technology. It gives creators and copyright owners the tools to protect the work and grow their business models. It provides clearer rules that will enable all Canadians to fully participate in the digital economy now and into the future. This legislation will bring Canada in line with the international standards and promote homegrown innovation and creativity. It is a fair, balanced, and common sense approach, respecting both the rights of the creators and the interests of consumers in a modern marketplace. The Government of Canada is working to secure Canada's place in the digital economy and to promote a more and prosperous and competitive Canada. Well, I did put a lot of emphasis on words that I thought stood out there. The rights of creators and the interests of consumers, as opposed to the interests of creators and the rights of consumers. So they're putting a lot of emphasis on the creators, the people, the copyright owners. Now, I'll get into some analysis here from a number of different people around who have interest in this. First one, I thought, outlined the point form very well. This is from Ars Technica. Canadian DMCA defends DRM and legalizes DVRs, sent in by Mind Inversion. Now, the first part here, they're outlining the good portions of this. And there are a lot of good portions of this. But there's a problem that is overall that defeats all the good things and nullifies them. I'll read it. Canada's long-awaited copyright modernization bill appeared today. If passed, it would explicitly legalize DVRs, YouTube mashups, backups, and parodies, and it would slap strong U.S.-style restrictions on bypassing DRM. Last time around, Canada's tough attempt at reforming its copyright laws fell apart over widespread public anger. The country learned its lesson, eventually embarking on a lengthy public consultation process before trying again. The product of these consultations dropped today in the form of Bill C-32. It provides a host of welcome changes to Canadian law and legalizes behavior that Canadians have been engaging in for years. The highlights. Time shifting. It's finally legal with an odd caveat. The individual keeps the recording no longer than it is reasonably necessary in order to listen or view the program at a more convenient time. In other words, no long-term archiving. Also, no giving recordings away, which is a funny thing. It doesn't specify how long you can keep this time-shifted recording. Now, I just watched a movie on my DVR that was recorded 6 months ago. I haven't got around to watching it. It was a movie. So, is that an unreasonable length of time? Would somebody at the somebody who owned the copyright holding to that movie saying, "We haven't watched it in 6 months. Come on. That's way too long." And send a little message along to my PVR and say, "Yeah, you can't watch it anymore because you took too long to watch it." Now, what is reasonably necessary? These are little wiggle words that I don't really like in law. When of course, the power is in the hands of the copyright holders to say, "We don't want you to have that recording anymore, and we're going to delete it." And then you go to your DVR and it says, "Sorry, you took too long." A little message pops up on your screen, and then all of a sudden it's gone. And you can't watch it for something that you've paid for through cable or satellite or some other means. You've given them the money, and they've taken away what you wanted to watch after you've given them the money. Now, second one, format shifting. Ripping CDs, finally, unambiguously legal. You need to own the source, original source material. This is for Canada, and that person who asked in the intro of the show is in the U.S., so this is a little bit different for Canada. And this is excellent. This is amazing. Great. Format shifting. You can take something and move it to something else. Anything you want. Now, I haven't gone in and read this because there's only a leaked version right now, I believe, out, and I'm going to have to read over it, but format shifting from anything to anything would be an amazing stride forward in copyright law in Canada. It's a common sense approach that somebody who owns something, who has purchased something legally, can watch it on anything they want, any device they want, anywhere they want. It's theirs. That is their right to be able to do it. And of course, they don't say it's a right. They say it's an interest of consumers and a right of the copyright holders. Backups. It's now legal for all digital works. Though you can't bypass DRM to make one, and the source must be a legitimate copy. We're going to get to the DRM later. Backups. You're allowed to back up anything you want. Anything you want. You've got a video, you want to back it up, fine. CD, back it up, fine. A piece of software, back it up, fine. Anything you want. Digital works, you can back it up on your hard drive, back it up onto a tape, back it up onto a DVD, CD, anything you want. Great. Statutory damage distinction. Statutory damages now apply differently to non-commercial infringers and can range from Canadian $100 to Canadian $5,000 in such cases. And commercial can range from $20,000 per infringement upward. Up to $20,000, which is quite a bit less than the U.S., which is $150,000 for non-commercial use. They make the comparison. So this is if you do abuse the copyright system. We'll get to how you can abuse it in a little bit. Mashup. C32 contains a section on non-commercial user-generated content that makes mashups legal, even when they use copyrighted content. Big applaud. That is an amazing thing. So long as they are non-commercial and mention the original creator. Now they're getting into the Creative Commons kind of aspect of things. This is amazing. This is great legislation. And don't have a substantial adverse effect on the market for the original work. Well, yeah, if you change like one bit of it, that's not a mashup. That's not creating something new. That's just, you know, changing 1 second of it and putting it back up. But still, this is really good. Temporary copies. The bill would legalize most temporary copies made by technical processes, such as caches and fleeting copies existing only in RAM. Now, this seems like a common sense thing, that you're watching something over the internet, it's streaming, there's DRM all over it, you're not allowed to copy, you're not allowed to back it up, you're not allowed to do anything but watch it with your eyeballs, but it's going through your RAM in your computer, it's going through your disk cache in your computer. This completely legalizes that process because it was ambiguous before. Computers were not as proliferated through the populace as it was before. So they have to make this distinction. This makes total sense that just because it's going through your computer in RAM, in cache, that does not mean that you're infringing. And this applies to websites as well. When you're looking at a website, it's caching those pictures. So if you go back to that website, you can see those pictures again without downloading them off the internet and wasting bandwidth, wasting time. This would legalize caching on your computer. Say it's a picture or an MP3 or a stream or something. It's cached on your computer. Totally fine. Parody. Canada's limited Fairlink dealing rights get us a boost with named copyright exemptions for research, private study, education, parody, or satire. Yes, we did not have a parody clause in Canada. In the U.S., they did. It was protected in the U.S., parody, making fun of something. So all those funny things about Star Wars or Star Trek or any kind of parody that's on the internet making fun of a movie or a person or something else, this is a great step forward. And it says, when it comes to ISP liability, the bill skips the U.S. notice and takedown model found in DMCA. Instead, it codifies a notice and notice regime. If a rights holder sends a copyright infringement letter to an ISP, the ISP does not need to take down or block access to that content. Instead, the ISP needs only to forward the notice to a subscriber in question. This keeps the dispute over infringement between two parties and keeps the ISPs from getting involved. Another amazing, astounding, common sense thing. Hallelujah. It's amazing. Great. The bill also ratchets up enforcement against peer-to-peer sites. It is an infringement of copyright for a person to provide, says the bill, by means of the internet or another digital network, a service that the person knows or should have known is designed primarily to enable act of copyright infringement. If an actual infringement of copyright incurs by means of the internet or another digital network as a result of a use of this service. That one is a little iffy, because everything on the internet is there to store text, store images, store audio, store video. Everything is there to store things and pass it on to somebody who visits a website or visits a service on the internet. Everything that is made in Canada, and I believe in US, is officially copyrighted as soon as a second you make it. So everything is copyrighted, and the internet is there to store it. This one is way too broad and does not make sense in terms of the internet, because that's how it works. It's designed primarily to enable acts of copyright infringement. Everything on the internet is designed primarily to enable acts of copyright infringement. Like, everything is copyrighted, so therefore, the whole internet is there to enable acts of copyright infringement. It doesn't make common sense. But the big new enforcement piece is the DMCA-style DRM provisions. Bypassing DRM won't be allowed, except in a few narrow cases. There's the crux of the whole thing. They give you all these rights, and in one fell swoop, right at the end, they take it all away. Because everything is marked with DRM. Everything that comes out of the major media corporations is marked with DRM. If it's on a Blu-ray, it's got encryption on it. If it's streamed over a website using specific software, it's got encryption on it. It's talking back to the original server saying, you can't do this, you can't do that. Everything is locked down. So if you bypass the DRM, you're not allowed to use it. So all these things that came before, the mashups, the backups, the format shifting, the time shifting, the temporary copies, the parodies, all that is gone because everything got DRM on it. Everything has DRM on it. You can't bypass it if it's got DRM. Well, then you can't bypass anything. It says, just as the U.S., the bill makes no exception for legal uses. DRM trumping fair dealing. Circumvention software and devices will also become illegal to sell or distribute. So CSS code, illegal in Canada. Anything that decrypts and enables you to make supposedly legal backups of your software, your movies, your CDs, your any kind of digital information is now null and void because it's got DRM on it. it's this provision that incenses copyright critics like law professor Michael Geist, who otherwise has a positive take on the bill. In other words, he says, in the battle between two sets of property rights, those of intellectual property rights holders and those of consumer who has purchased the tangible or intangible property, the IP rights holder always wins, he writes. This represents market intervention for a particular business model by a government supposedly committed to the free market, and it means that the existing fair dealing rights, including research, private study, news reporting, criticism, and review, and the proposed new rights, parody, satire, education, time-shifting, format-shifting, and backup copies, all cease to function effectively so long as the rights holder places a digital lock on their content or device. He obviously is able to better eloquently say what I said right there. The bill remains open to amendment, and it, as it moves through the legislative sausage grinder, Canadians who care about these issues will be well advised to contact their MPs quickly, perhaps noting that ratifying the 1996 WIPO Internet Treaties, a one big goal of C-32, does not actually require this sort of approach to DRM. So there you have it. It lays it on the line. Thank you, Ars Technica, for actually laying it out for an understandable, in an understandable way, so that it shows that you're given all these rights and then you're taken away. It's like going into a candy shop and saying, well, you can have all the, if you buy any of these candies, you can do anything you want with it. You can give it to your friends. You can share it. You can, you know, keep it for later, but you can't take the wrapping off the candy. If you take the wrapping off the candy, that's it. You can't eat it. Well, how do I eat it without taking the wrapping off the candy? Well, you can't. But I want to eat it. Well, if you eat it, you'd have to take the wrapping off. It doesn't make any sense. It takes away all the rights that are given to you, all these amazing things that are outlined here that make common sense, that everybody is doing anyway, that people want to do. And I'll show you later that even the people in government are doing this. The people who are proposing this, Tony Clement, is breaking the law through what he's proposing. And it doesn't make common sense. It doesn't fall in line with what people are doing. Now, this is the press release from the Pirate Party of Canada. Today, June 2nd, 2010, the Conservative Party has restarted a process which it had hoped to finish years ago. Today, they opened their copyright modernization bill to the public. To give a brief history of the bill, in 2005, the Conservative Party of Canada introduced the controversial Bill C-60, which was met with public outcry against an assault on personal freedoms and died on the order paper when the opposition passed a motion of non-confidence and sent Canadians to the polls. An even stronger version was introduced in 2008 as Bill C-61, which also died when another election was called. Seemingly in response to this strong opposition, the Conservative government launched a consultation on the subject in the summer of 2009. Response was immediate, and over 90% of more than 8,300 submissions were opposed to a repeat of Bill C-61. In fact, most favored shorter copyright terms, strengthened fair dealing exceptions, and the elimination of a legal prohibition on DRM circumvention. As we can see based on the new bill, the government has no regard for the clear and overwhelming opinion of the Canadian public. Instead, it wants to introduce another draconian bill known as informally as the Canadian DMCA for its similarities to the controversial and ineffective legislation presented in the United States. The bill will include prohibitions on the breaking of digital locks, which will undermine fair dealing by making it next to impossible to copy most media bought for personal use. This defeats the Tory attempt at balancing out their bill by allowing consumers to copy media for personal use, yet not allowing them to unlock the media in order to copy it. In response to this legislation, the Pirate Party of Canada is preparing to flex its growing network of activist muscle to arrange protests against this violation of Canadian consumers' rights, coordinate with other concerned organizations, and to reach out to politicians and news organizations to reinforce the past and inevitable future outcry against this legislation. As the only party in Canada genuinely concerned with protecting Canadians' digital freedoms, the PPCA is advocating for the expansion of fair dealing legislation in order to preserve, protect, and increase the consumer's personal use rights on their media. We would also like to scale back copyright to a period between 5 and 15 years, as opposed to the current life of the author plus 50. Ultimately, the party will be running a number of candidates in the next general election, standing as the only Canadian political party genuinely concerned with protecting all Canadians against the growing influence of copyright lobby groups. Founded in 2009, the Pirate Party of Canada was established to protect the rights of consumers and of intellectual property against increasingly draconian laws enacted in response to the demands of corporate interests. Specifically, the party is committed to reforming Canadian copyright laws, encouraging innovation through patent reform, protecting all Canadian citizens with strengthened privacy laws, and affirming their right to monitor their government by promoting the ideals of open government. So it's summed up perfectly right here, where it says allows consumers to copy media for personal use, yet not allowing them to unlock the media in order to copy it. It's saying one thing and then taking it right away. And it doesn't even make sense to the people promoting this law, because they're currently breaking the law that they're proposing. Another story came out a couple days ago. It says industry minister admits to breaking copyright law to build an iPod collection, sent in by Weird Wolf. Industry minister Tony Clement, who's one of the people who put forward this bill, has an admission to make. He built his impressive music library on his iPod in part by breaking Canada's copyright law. Mr. Clement stick handling the copyright file for the Conservative government, along with the Heritage Minister James Moore, is poised to introduce, well, they already introduced it, but until that law is updated to permit Canadians to transfer music onto MP3 players from CDs they have purchased, Mr. Clement stands on the wrong side of Canada's copyright law. And now you're saying, well, CDs don't have a DRM on it. Well, wait a second, some of them do. Some of them had restrictions on them, so that when you placed it in your computer, it popped up with software that prevented you from doing it. I believe one of them was called Secure ROM. Somebody can correct me on that. But there was a number of implementations that prevented the, or tried to prevent the copying or converting of CDs to other digital formats. So maybe did he circumvent some DRM? So maybe he's breaking the law right now and he's proposing something that would circumvent that, but there still are CDs out there that have DRM on it. Did he just circumvent this DRM that would also be illegal in the future? Says, well, you see, you know, I think I have to admit it probably runs afoul of the current law, because the current law does not allow you to shift formats. So the fact of the matter is I have compact discs that I have transferred. I have compact discs for my children or my wife that have transferred onto my iPod. None of that is allowable under the current regime. Mr. Clement, a music buff who also legally purchases songs from iTunes to build a digital database that now stands at 10,452 songs. It shows that our current regime is not realistic and is not modern to encompass how people obtain their entertainment in the today's world, said Mr. Clement, calling the current law antiquated. So what he is doing is demonstrating that he does not agree with the current laws, and how he demonstrates against the current laws is by breaking the current laws. So this shows you what the current attitude of the government is right now. And maybe they're trying to set an example for other people who do not agree with our antiquated copyright laws, or even the proposed copyright laws that he's trying to put forward. He is currently breaking the law by circumventing the laws of format shifting. And in the future, maybe he's also breaking the DRM laws of these certain CDs that did not allow that as well. It goes on. That's what happens in a family. You do tend to share music that way. And I think most people would find that to be perfectly acceptable behavior. But our current law is so antiquated, it doesn't contemplate that situation. So I wonder if in the future, other people breaking the DRM laws, if he would be okay with that, because it doesn't contemplate that situation, or it's perfectly acceptable behavior. Well, we'll have to see if he will be open in the future to people doing protesting in that way against the laws. And somebody who did protest many, many decades ago, Mr. Rogers. If people haven't heard about this, I wanted to bring this up in light of the Canadian laws being proposed in this bill. Mr. Rogers and the VCRs, a lot of you have probably heard this, his 1979 testimony in the case of Sony Corporation versus America, Sony Corporation of America versus Universal City Studios, noted that he did not object to home recording of his television programs, for instance, by families in order to watch them at a later time. This testimony contrasted with the views of others in the television industry who objected to home recording or believed that devices to facilitate it should be taxed or regulated. The Supreme Court considered the testimony of Rogers in its decision that held that the Betamax video recorder did not infringe copyright. The court stated that his views were a notable piece of evidence that many television producers are willing to allow private time shifting to continue, and even quoted his testimony in a footnote. This is what he said. Some public stations, as well as commercial stations, program the neighborhood at hours when some children cannot use it. I have always felt that with the advent of all this new technology that allows people to tape the neighborhood off air, and I'm speaking for the neighborhood because that's what I produce, that they would become much more active in the programming of their family's television life. Very frankly, I'm opposed to people being programmed by others. My whole approach in broadcasting has always been, you're an important person just the way you are. You can make healthy decisions. Maybe I'm going on too long, but I just feel that anything that allows a person to be more active in the control of his or her life in a healthy way is important. The Home Recording Rights Coalition later stated that Rogers was one of the most prominent witnesses on this issue. So way back, even in 1979, 30 years ago, Mr. Rogers understood the importance of being able to use the media that you own in any way you want, being able to time shift it and use it at a time on a medium that is convenient for you is important so that we can advance and learn and go forward as a society. So we're going to go across the border now to the U.S. Copyright news from the U.S. I've never heard of Far Cry, says P2P defendant. This was sent in by Mind Inversion. Last week, the law firm of Dunlap, Grubb, and Weaver dropped a letter in the mail. A few days ago, it was opened by a woman who we'll call Sabine. She'd asked their identity to be kept private, and some details and dates of her case have been altered to maintain anonymity. And it informed her that she'd be identified swapping the film Far Cry on a peer-to-peer network during the night of March 22nd. Sabine could pay the lawyers, they accept credit cards, $1,500 by early June to make the problem go away, said the letter. Waiting until the end of June increased the payoff amount to $2,500. The offer was extremely reasonable in the lawyer's view. Well, it's too late to undo the illegal file sharing you've already done. We have prepared an offer to enable the rights holder to recoup the damages incurred by your action and defray the cost of preventing this type of activity in the future. Should Sabine not pay up, the consequences could be life-altering. Dunlap, Grubb, and Weaver could take her to court where the lawyers could try to prove her actions intentional. And once they did that, our client would be seeking the maximum statutory damages allowed by the Copyright Act in the amount of $150,000 per infringement, attorney fees, and costs. The demand is breathtaking. While the Copyright Act does, in fact, allow a maximum of $150,000 per infringement, rights holders rarely ask for this astonishing amount against individuals' peer-to-peer users. The recording industry over the years of lawsuits famously refused ever to ask juries for the specific amount. The industry, whatever its faults, was attuned to the optics of the situation, and trying to crush young people beneath a mountain of unpayable debt for file swapping isn't the sort of thing most public relations professionals want to do. Neither do juries. In the two most famous peer-to-peer cases from the music industry campaign, juries awarded wildly variable amounts of $9,250, $80,000, and $22,500 per song infringed in the Jamie Thomas Rassett case was retired, resulting in a second judgment. Left to their own devices, no jury thought $150,000 was close to appropriate. So that's an example of what's going on in the States. Here's another example. That's from the movie Far Cry. This one's for the Hurt Locker. Hurt Locker downloaders, you've been sued, sent in by Mind and Virgin. Everybody's heard about this now because it was a very major movie as opposed to Far Cry, which I believe is made by U-Bowl, which is he's kind of the joke of the internet. Producers of the Oscar-winning film The Hurt Locker has made good on a promise to file copyright lawsuits against people who illegally shared the movie via peer-to-peer networks. Voltage Pictures, an independent production company, filed a copyright complaint on Monday against 5,000 John Does in federal court in Washington, D.C. According to court records, next on the company's to-do list is to learn the names of John and Jane Does from their internet service providers. Attorneys for Voltage wrote in a complaint that is, unless the court stops the people who pirate the Hurt Locker, then Voltage will suffer a great and irreparable injury that cannot fully be compensated or measured in money. That's kind of strange that it couldn't be measured in money, because it's a corporation who measures everything in money. Voltage asked the court to order anyone who downloaded the movie illegally to destroy all copies of The Hurt Locker on their computer or any other electronic device they have made, may have stored the film. As for monetary damages, the movie's producers did not ask for specific figures, but that want those found to have pilfered the movie to pay actual or statutory damages and cover the costs that went into filing the suits. The Hurt Locker producers aren't the first to kick off this new round of suits against individuals. A company calling itself the U.S. Copyright Group seems to be spearheading these efforts and has filed lawsuits on behalf of 10 other movies, including Far Cry and Call of the Wild 3D. None of those flicks have come close to earning the notoriety of The Locker. The film won 6 Academy Awards this year, including one for Best Picture. The movie was a disappointment at the box office, however, grossing only $16 million domestically. Although, if you look it up, they made, I think, 3 times the amount that the movie cost, and they made a healthy profit. Nonetheless, a film with the Oscar pedigree could potentially whip up a lot of sympathy among independent filmmakers for the idea of taking a stand against file sharing. But the filing of a lawsuit does not a successful legal campaign make, not when you're talking about the volume of file shares Voltage has set its sights on. This is well-tread ground, after all. The 4 top record companies attempted to use litigation as a deterrent for 5 years and were confronted by bad publicity, big legal costs, and this little nugget. The suits didn't slow illegal file sharing. And the labels are large corporations with lots of cash to fund anti-piracy operations. Voltage is relatively small and isn't backed by the Motion Picture Association of America, the trade group representing the 6 largest film studios, including Disney, Sony Pictures, and Paramount Pictures. The MPAA employs staff to help prevent studio-backed films from leaking to the web and track them down when they occur. It appears the copyright group, which is private, has nothing to do with the government despite the official sounding name, is offering small film companies a means to fight back against piracy. So what they're doing is offering and saying, just like the last one, it's the same company represented Far Cry, $1,500 if you respond in a month, $2,500 if you pass that mark, and if you don't respond after that, we take you to court. I responded to Pirate Party UK post in Facebook about this story. I said, unfortunately, some artists believe that they have a right to make money because they made a movie or made a record. Their old business model has collapsed, and they have moved on to the new business model of litigation income. The sad thing is that random lawsuits against IP addresses are working, as a people would rather settle out of court for $2,500 plus than take it to court. The settlement amount is cleverly crafted. It's a cleverly crafted number to maximize profit and minimize court time, all at the cost of a threatening piece of paper. Which, you know, they've already got it set up. They've got the system set up. So if a new movie company didn't think they made quite enough money in the box office, they can approach the company called the U.S. Copyright Group, put their name down on a piece of paper, and they'll look for IP addresses sharing that movie so they can make a little bit more money because they didn't think that they made quite enough and that these people downloading and sharing these movies on the internet would have definitely shelled out the cash to watch their movie. And I didn't even hear this story, but somebody sent it in my mind inversion. Piracy will earn Hurt Locker more than the box office. 2 days ago, the makers of Hurt Locker filed a complaint against the first 5,000, blah, blah, blah. And then it gives some background about Hurt Locker. With the document, alleged infringers have the option to settle the case for $2,500 and avoid further legal action. Because the case is similar to that of Hurt Locker, we'll assume the similar settlement amount will be proposed, just as I assumed it would be. It's the same company, same process. This allows us to calculate how much money is involved in this case, and the results are quite interesting. Thomas Dunlap, a lawyer at the USCG, earlier said that the Hurt Locker case, they would pursue tens of thousands of users. Let's be careful with our estimate and assume that some of the 20,000 BitTorrent users will eventually receive a settlement letter in the mail. Of these, half will choose to pay the $2,500 without complaining, a number that seems to be fair based on the results of similar schemes. If the above scenario becomes reality, the Hurt Locker would make $25 million in settlements alone in the coming months. The number could, of course, go much higher as thousands of people are still downloading the movie every day. With this $25 million, the movie makers would have collected more money from BitTorrent users than they did from the U.S. movie theater visitors. See, they're only suing people in the U.S., so they're comparing against how much it brought in the U.S. The movie cost $15 million to make. It made $16 domestically in the U.S. It made twice that much in overseas and around the world, but only 16. And they're standing to make $25 million from the lawsuits. Now you can see why it's so attractive to go this route. And now why wouldn't every company start contacting this corporation to sue on behalf of them? Where's the possible loss? Where could they lose out? They have the money, the backing, the lawyers to beat these people in court. I read another story. I didn't want to include too many stories about this, about what people are trying to do. They're writing handwritten letters back to this company saying, please, please don't sue me. I'm going to be devastated. I will be crushed. I will be not able to go to court to pay these fees. They can't even pay the $1,500 or $2,500 to make the problem go away. They just don't have the money. And these are the people that they think that will be buying their movies and going to the movies in the first place when they don't have enough money to do any of this. They wouldn't have put the $10 or $20 in your pocket to go see the movie anyway. They don't have the money. You're not losing money from them. You have made your money. You've made your money in the theaters. You're going to make your money on the DVD sales at home. You have to go with the new business model. But this is the new business model they're going after. The settlement money is not net profit for the makers of Hurt Locker, though, as they have to give up to 70% of it to the USCG. Wow. So the people that are really making the money are the lawyers, which is not really a surprise, as they've always made the money. This whole scheme is no way intended to protect the copyrights of the Hurt Locker producers. USCG don't want to go to court at all. They want to see money as much as possible without too much trouble. Lengthy and costly court-led cases would only get in the way of this goal and could even bust the whole scheme if they lose. So there's actually nothing to say that they'd even take it to court. Right now, they're just threatening letters that a lot of people would go and pay to stay out of court, because court costs, the first day would cost $2,500 as you brought your papers to the lawyer. As they started researching it, lawyers cost a lot of money per hour. So that is the new realm of copyright in the U.S. and how they are trying to make money with movies. So any budding movie makers out there, there is the new way to make your money. Put together a movie, have it accidentally leak onto the internet. You don't even need to have it accidentally leak. Then just sue everyone who downloads it. Or not even sue them, just threaten them. Send some letters. Sign up this company. You stand to make 30% off of every dollar that you get back from these pieces of paper threatening people with blackmail of taking them to court. And, you know, it's kind of blackmail because who knows if they're going to take them to court. You're just threatening them to take them to court. We'll see if they actually do follow through. And hopefully somebody out there is a lawyer or knows some lawyers and shows them the errors of their ways and the way that things are happening nowadays. Privacy news from the UK. Identity card scheme will be axed within 100 days. Applause for the UK. They're following through on some of those promises that I said last week. Senate by Mind Inversion. The national identity card scheme will be abolished within 100 days, with all cards becoming invalid, Home Secretary Theresa May has said. Legislation to axe the scheme will be first put before Parliament by the new government, with the target of it becoming law by August. So it does have to pass first. It's not set in stone, but the 15,000 people who voluntarily paid £30 for a card since 2009 rollout in Manchester will not get a refund. Ms. May said ID card holders would at least have a souvenir of the scheme. The Labour scheme was aimed at tackling fraud, legal immigration, identity theft, but it was criticised for being too expensive and infringement of civil liberties. The cards were designed to hold personal biometric data on an encrypted chip, including name, a photograph, and fingerprints. The supporting National Identity Register were designed to hold up to 50 pieces of information. So, excellent news. Hopefully this will pass and people can get their biometric information off of cards and back into their body where it belongs, and not in a database where it can be exposed and accidentally leaked onto the internet with a badly run database. For some reason connected to the internet. You know, these things leak out, and once you lose your biometrics, that's it for you. You can't change your biometrics. You can change your name, but you can't change who you are. Privacy news from the U.S. Congress looks to block anonymous prepaid phone sales to fight terrorism. Sent in by Wiondi. Getting an anonymous prepaid phone may be a lot harder in the U.S. A new bill introduced by Senators Charles Schumer and John Cornyn would require buyers of prepaid cell phones to show ID at the point of purchase, and will require phone companies to store this info for law enforcement purposes. The move comes after revelation that the terrorism suspect involved in the attempt bombing in New York City Times Square used an anonymous prepaid cell phone to disguise his identity when purchasing loads of highly explosive M88 fireworks and a Nissan Pathfinder. Commonly, such purchases would alert the FBI and allow the individual involved to be tracked. In this case, though, the anonymous handset covered the terrorism suspect's tracks. Schumer describes, "We caught a break in catching the Times Square's terrorist, but usually a prepaid cell phone is dead end for law enforcement. There's no reason why it should still be this easy for terror plotters to cover their tracks." So, another thing to put in place, another law to be put in place to inconvenience consumers in the guise of stopping terrorism. Because, you know, as soon as this law goes in place, terrorists will definitely give their proper ID when purchasing a cell phone to do their illegal work. You need my ID. Well, let me get my real ID out of my wallet here. Oh, yes. My name is Mike Smith. Yes, it is. Yes, see my picture? Looks authentic, doesn't it? Just put Mike Smith down. And, you know, here's my proper, you know, ID. And here's $20 for it. Yeah, you can record that. Write that down. My name is Mike Smith. If you ever have a problem, you can call me on my, you know, cell phone right here that I'm purchasing from you. They're not going to use real ID. And either that, or they're going to buy black market cell phones that are purchased by other people. How you do that is you get a bunch of people and say, "Oh, if you want to go in there, buy a cell phone. I'll give you $100 for the cell phone. It's prepaid, so you know you're not going to lose out any money on this because they're not going to send you a bill because it's all prepaid. There's no back end bills. When the money runs out, it runs out. So I'll give you $100, $200, $500. I'll give you to go into 7-Eleven and buy this phone for me. Okay, no big deal. You get the phone. Give it to me. I give you $500. We both go our different ways. Everybody's happy. This will not stop anything. This is a ruse. This will not help terrorism go away. All it does is inconvenience people that are purchasing legal cell phones and just inconveniencing them. It doesn't help fight terrorism. This is theater security. It does not do a thing. And I've looked up for people who are concerned and don't understand why they people who don't understand why they should be concerned about anonymity. I do stress points here and there, but I looked it up and found it a pretty decent write-up about the importance of anonymity. And say you're buying this cell phone and you don't want people to know who you are for a certain reason. Now, this outlines some reasons why you would not want to be known, and not because you're doing illegal activities. That's not all the reasons you want to be anonymous. There's many reasons that people don't think about. They always think, oh, you're a criminal as soon as you want to be anonymous. Why don't you want your face shown? Well, here's some reasons. The society, this is reading from this page, the society in which we live can frequently and be extremely conservative, often making it dangerous to make certain statements, have certain opinions, or adopt a certain lifestyle. Anonymity is important for online discussions involving sexual abuse, minority issues, harassment, sex lives, and many other things. Additionally, anonymity is useful for people who want to ask technical questions that they don't want to admit they don't know the answer to, report illegal activities without fear of retribution, and many other things. For example, the state of Florida maintains an anonymous hotline for government workers to report wastes and abuses to the comptroller's office. Without anonymity, these actions can result in public ridicule or censure, physical injury, loss of employment or status, and in some cases, even legal action. Protection from harm resulting from this type of social intolerance is a definite example of important and legitimate use of anonymity on the internet. And that's just a short summary of what I found on that page. It goes on and on about more important examples of why anonymity is important in even the best of countries. In the worst of countries, where you can get beaten for things that you say and killed for things that you say legally, or things that you do legally, anonymity is the height of importance, where they judge you morally on things that you do and can destroy you and harm you physically for things that you do because they don't think they're morally right. And anonymity is incredibly important. In worldwide privacy and free speech news, WikiLeaks was launched with documents intercepted from Tor, sent by Nephilim. There's a couple things we can learn from this story. WikiLeaks, a controversial whistleblowing site that exposes secrets of governments and corporations, bootstrapped itself with a cache of documents obtained through the internet eavesdropping operation by one of its activists, according to a new profile of the organization's founder. The activists siphoned more than 1 million documents as they traveled across the internet through Tor, also known as the Onion Router, a sophisticated privacy tool that lets users navigate and send documents through the internet anonymously. The siphoned documents, supposedly stolen by Chinese hackers or spies who are using Tor network to transmit the data, were the basis for WikiLeaks founders Julian Assange's assertions in 2006 that his organization had already received over 1 million documents from 13 countries before the site was launched, according to the article in New Yorker. Only a small portion of those intercepted documents were ever posted on WikiLeaks, but the new report is the first indication that some of the data and documents in WikiLeaks did not come from sources who intended for the documents to be seen or posted. It also explains the enduring mystery of WikiLeaks' launch. How did the organization was able to amass a collection of secret documents before its website was opened for business? Tor is a sophisticated privacy tool endorsed by the Electronic Frontier Foundation and other civil liberties groups, a method for whistleblowers and human rights workers to communicate with journalists, with, among other uses. In its search for government and corporate secrets traveling through the Tor network, it's conceivable that WikiLeaks may have also vacuumed up sensitive information from human rights workers who did not want their data to be seen by outsiders. Now, every time I see Tor posted anywhere, people always say, it's not secure, it's not a secure thing, don't send stuff through it. Yes, it's not a secure thing. It's for anonymizing your data, so nobody knows where it comes from. Of course, if you include information in the things that you're sending, like your name, if you type your name in a document you're sending through Tor, yes, that's going to be revealed. Anything you send through Tor can be intercepted, but they don't know where it came from. That's the thing with Tor. That's what it's used for. It's for anonymous speech, not encrypted speech, not protected speech, anonymous speech. And people always get this mixed up. The two are not one and the same. Anonymity and encryption or privacy are two different things. Do not get them mixed up. And this is a perfect example of the distinction and why people are mixing them up so much. You have to get them straight. They're not one and the same. They can go hand in hand, but they don't always. Copyright news from the copyright news from the UK. The Times paywall, an end to sharing. Sent by Mind Inversion. Now, this is very interesting. I'm very interested in how this plays out. A great experiment is about to get underway, and it'll teach us much about the future of journalism and the willingness of readers to pay for it. In Wapping last night, News International showed off the new websites for The Times and Sunday Times, which have opened to the public this morning. 4 weeks from now, a paywall will go up in the front of the sites, and by News International's own calculation, more than 90% of their audience will melt away. Both new sites look engaging and attractive. They're very different after years of operating online under the same banner. Each newspaper now wants to reassert its identity. The Times is a clean, simple look, much like the paper itself, with its accent on news complemented by interactive graphics and video. The Sunday Times looks far more like a magazine, emphasizing the kind of material that has a shelf life beyond the day of publication. Among the special online offerings are a weekly satirical look at the news by video artist Alan Jackson, a cultural planner which you can use to book theater or cinema tickets directly from the site or even set your Sky Plus recorder. So, let's see, if you want a quick hit of in-depth news, you go to the Times. If on a Monday, Tuesday, or Wednesday you want to tour a little and come back a snack on the Sunday Times has to offer, if that is you're willing to pay £1 for a day or £2 for a week's access. That is, this is more than just an experiment in whether people pay for news. It's a strike against prevailing philosophy of online journalism, which says that the most important thing is to make your material shareable to the widest possible audience. So what they're going to do is lock down their website. Google won't be able to get in to see the news. They won't share with Google. People will not be able to access it at all from outside. You need a subscription to get in. Now, they're going to see if people are willing to support this type of journalism, whether the walled garden is the way to go or ad-supported is the way to go. And it's going to be very interesting to see how this plays out. Children 4 years old to be fingerprinted to borrow school books from the library. This privacy news from the U.S. sent in by Nephilim. Students in Manchester. Oh, I think I mixed this up. This is supposed to be from the U.K., actually. Students in Manchester are having their thumbprints digitally transformed to electronic codes, which can then be recognized by a computer program. Under the scheme, pupils swipe a barcode inside the book they want to borrow, then press their thumb onto a scanner to authorize the loan. Books are returned in the same way. The scheme is being trialed on junior classes at Higher Lane Primary in Whitefield Bury, Greater Manchester. Officials confirm it's due to be extended to all pupils at the school, one of the area's largest primary schools, with 453 pupils aged 4 to 11. School authorities defended the scheme on Thursday and moved to reassure parents that the voluntary system is heavily encrypted or coded and that no images of fingerprints would be stored. But critics say they're appalled at the system developed by Microsoft, which is also being trialed in other parts of the country. This is quite clearly appalling, said Phil Booth, national coordinator of No2ID, a privacy campaign group. For such a trivial issue as taking out library books, the taking of fingerprints is way over the top and wrong. It conditions children to hand over sensitive personal information. He added, the money for such a system could be spent on actual school resources. How about some more books for the library instead? This needs to be rolled back or stopped. I would argue there's no justification for a scheme, and I would argue the same. There's no need for fingerprints to be taken, for biometric ID to be taken. These children have names. They can write the name on the book. They don't need to spend however much it took to purchase this system with a back end by Microsoft and a front end taking your fingerprints and biometrically storing the data in point data. I don't care if it doesn't take your whole fingerprint. It has scanned your fingerprint in as data. It has encoded it in point form of your fingerprint that can be matched. And I'm sure it has a certain level of matching ability that you're going to be one out of a million, one out of a billion, one out of some number. So that's going to be unique. Otherwise, there's no point in implementing such a system. So it's biometrically storing your data uniquely so that it's just you. Then this system can be applied outside. And the other point is that it's just getting used people and kids getting used to giving their personal information up at the drop of the hat, when people should be more educated about keeping their information private. It's swinging, the pendulum swings so far the other way of your private information being given out willy-nilly when there's rampant identity theft around the world of people being taken advantage of because they're not educated on how their identity can be stolen. For the easiest example of your credit being shot because somebody's just taking your identity out of your mailbox. Imagine if they had your full biometric information in terms of your iris print or your fingerprint and your DNA imprint or any other kind of biometric information. That is out there forever. That cannot be undone. If somebody leaks a database like this, this kind of biometric information should be handled so carefully under such strict conditions. Maybe the only reason you could have this biometric information be stored is in convicted felon database. That is the only thing I can imagine there'd be a reason, a need for storing somebody's biometric information. There's no need to be this invasive in our society to store personal information to this level of extent, especially not in kids that are 4 years old and indoctrinating them to a lifetime of giving up their information. Copyright news from the UK. Ofcom unveils anti-piracy policy sent in by Mind Inversion. This one is frightening if this goes through. List of Britons who infringe copyright would be drawn up by the UK's biggest ISPs under proposals from the regulator Ofcom. Ofcom's like the FCC in the US or CRTC in Canada. The plan is contained in a draft code of practice. It will hope to curb copyright infringement. Names and the numbers of times individuals infringed will be logged. Music firms and movie studios can request details from the list so they can decide whether to start their own actions against serial infringers. However, any suspected infringers will be sent 3 warning letters before any action can be taken. Just that intro raises so many questions. Okay, this is Ofcom enforcing upon... This is not going to go through. I can tell you right now, it's just rife with craziness. Ofcom is asking the ISPs, without intervention from the media corporations, to start logging and tracking their customers for any copyright infringement. How they're going to differentiate copyright infringement from non-copyright infringement. I'm a media producer. I put my stuff out on the web. It's in .avi form. People are allowed to torrent it. I put up torrents so people can download it. How are they going to differentiate some movie corporation that has lockdown on everything they make as opposed to me who shares their information so that they can see that this torrent is good and this torrent is bad and you're going to be marked down for number of times this torrent? Or maybe they're not even going to differentiate that. Maybe they're going to track all torrents that you download off the internet, whether it's from me or from some other place. So I later can go to an Ofcom supported UK ISP and go, okay, I need a list of everybody who downloaded this movie. And, can you just hand that over to me so I can sue them all? That'd be great. I don't know how this is going to pass, how they're going to store all this information. There's a lot of data. How many hard drives are they going to have to purchase to be able to store all this information? It's clearly they're going to have to work on this kind of thing. Patent news from India. India steps up to plate to fight U.S. Active Piracy Pact. Sent in by Mind Inversion. This is not unexpected, but I don't think anybody saw this coming. President George W. Bush and President Barack Obama over the last several years have masterminded an international piracy pact called ACTA. We all know about that. A major world power may finally be ready to stand up to the U.S.'s controversial treaty. A major Indian politician speaking with the Indian Times under a condition of anonymity, there you go, there's a perfect reason to use it, said their country was mounting a resistance effort. States the source, we will hold talks with like-minded countries, read Brazil, China, Egypt, the people who weren't invited to the ACTA agreements, and may oppose the ACTA proposal jointly as well as individually by holding talks with countries involved. India is particularly worried about the certain patent provision of the treaty. For example, if India sent Mexico a shipment of pharmaceuticals not covered by patents in those countries, but covered by patents in the U.S., U.S. customs officials could seize that shipment at sea. So the U.S. has nothing to do with these two countries, but can go in and seize something and check their pharmaceuticals that are being shipped from one country to another. That is why they don't want this to pass, because of the complete control, world control by the pharmaceutical companies through their patents to be able to lock down the entire world from life-saving information that could be used on the cheap. Rather than let people die, they would rather hold this medicine from them. But you can read in the article there, it's very interesting that they're going to be mounting this. It's not unexpected, and kudos to India for taking up this cause. Privacy news from the EU. EU to monitor all internet searches. This is from the blog of Christian Engstrom, the member of European Parliament, who's Pirate Party of Sweden, who's from the Pirate Party of Sweden. Written Declaration 29 has been marketed within the European Parliament using a very emotionally loaded picture of a child and talking about the need to set up an early warning system to combat sexual child abuse. In reality, however, the substance of the declaration is to call on the Commission to extend the data retention directive to search engines so that all searches done on, for example, Google will be monitored. It is understandable if many members of European Parliament have been misled into signing the declaration, since the data retention directive is never mentioned in any of the marketing material for the declaration. It is only referred by its number, 2006-24-EC, in the declaration itself. You can read more about the background in my previous blog post, Written Declaration 29 for Data Retention of Internet Searches. MEP Cecilia Wilkstrom from the Liberal group ALDE has written a letter to all fellow MEPs, explaining how she was misled into signing the declaration. So this is exactly where the Pirate Party is stepping in to show people what is actually going on and how they're being misled by people slipping through appealing to emotion by showing pictures of children, please stop the abuse, and compiling databases of all your private or so-called private information, which is not private anymore, and compiling major, major databases of things that you don't want other people to see. Now, recently, Google has launched a secure search site, https://. So as long as the government does not have the keys to that kingdom, they cannot be retaining that information. But as soon as this kind of thing passes, they can. They can force Google to hand over all your searches, and you can see why that can be a distressing thing. And everybody will have to turn to Tor to get their information. Now, some more distressing news about privacy coming from Australia. NSW government recording features for facial recognition. The New South Wales government is quietly compiling a mathematical map of almost every adult's face, sharing information that allows law enforcement to track people by CCTV. Experts said yesterday few people realized their facial features was being recorded in an RTA database of driver's license photos that the government has allowed both state and federal police to access. The federal body CrimTac has asked NSW for its database so it can be mined nationally by police using facial recognition information contained in it. University experts in facial recognition said that the correct match was as low as 90%, meaning the names of people with faces sharing similar structure to criminals could be returned in searches. Dr. Carolyn Semler from the University of Adelaide said police warned to eventually use facial recognition in smart CCTV cameras, allowing people to be tracked anywhere there was a camera. Some airports, such as Singapore, employ facial recognition technology, as the U.S. is considering using it at border crossings. Police hope that at some point an individual can be tracked, Dr. Semler said yesterday. So they need to either get rid of this or up the percentage of correct matches, 90%. Is not good. So if you are close to a criminal's face, they're going to track and say you were there doing the crime and the criminal wasn't, just because you match the criminal. Something somebody else does is going to be pinned on you. And this is why biometrics are a danger. This is a perfect example of why they should not be allowed for the general public making massive database because of the inexacting of the database matching that can go on. And they're saying this is only 90%. And that's an unreasonable amount. This should be much, much higher than 90% if they're going to start putting this in place. And they're starting to make inaccurate databases. There needs to be some more checks and balances going on. They need some more points to map these people's faces out or scrap the whole thing entirely. And they shouldn't be databasing innocent people's faces. They should be, if at anything, databasing criminals who have been convicted. Not arrestees, not people who are suspected, not the general public. Now in Pirate Party news, Pirate Party of Canada IRC meeting is on June 19th. The next online meeting is scheduled for June 19th at 8 p.m. Eastern Time. The meetings take place in the IRC channel and last approximately 1.5 to 2 hours. So everybody in Canada, especially in light of what's coming down the pipeline in the C-32 Act, please show up. Even if you're not a party member, to even take a look at what's going on and what's being discussed. And news from Ireland, 300 member milestone. What's next? As you may have noticed, we've crossed the magical milestone of 300 party members. That is first requirement to register with the OI Reach Task. I'm not sure what that means. I'm sure people in Ireland know what that is. The next thing we need to do is hold an inaugural AGM to get all of you in one room to form a full-fledged political organization and bring the party forward towards inevitable success. So congratulations to the Pirate Party of Ireland for passing the milestone to get going. And I've got some stuff for the media section sent in by Platon. Piracy, again, by Joe Conrath. It says, in the past 24 hours, four separate writers have emailed me to tell me my books are being stolen online. Well, no duh. The internet was created to share and distribute data. It's the whole reason the World Wide Web exists. Of course, some of the data is going to be copyright-protected work. If it be digitized, it can be and will be shared. So this person is giving a good write-up of an example of how to work in the new paradigm of people downloading and sharing your information. This guy's still making money and giving away his books for free. And other people are commenting to him saying, hey, I saw your book being shared online. Why don't you go after that and stop it? Well, he recognizes that these are potential future customers being shown what is good out there and what can be offered to them. And if they go to the original source, they can get even more stuff from the author. It is called advertising. So I've got a closing track here. It's from Lawrence Lessig, Innovation Corruption. And this is a talk you can take a look at. It says, from the description of the talk, his message was consistently simple and resounding. Government and business are corrupted by money. This corruption becomes a roadblock to innovation because regulation designed not for the social good, but to maximize the money to Congress. The only way to fix this is to get money out of the system, a system Lessig referred to as the economy of influence. So remember, if any of these stories have interested you, please check out your local Pirate Party to find out more of what you can do to help preserve your rights and freedoms. If you have news stories you'd like to hear on the show, questions or comments, just head over to thepiratepartyradio.com and submit them to the forum on the website. Thank you for listening. And until next time, this has been James O'Brien for Pirate Party Radio.
We've been waging this war in the context of copyright, what we call the copyright wars, what my friend, the late Jack Valenti, head of the Motion Picture Association, used to refer to as his own, quote, terrorist war, where apparently the terrorists in this war are our children. We've been waging this war for a decade, and we've seen no substantial decline in the number of people using digital technologies to engage in illegal activity. And so what we need to do when we wage a war that is failing is to sue for peace and find a different way to achieve the objectives that that war sought. And in particular, what people like you need to help us do is to convince policymakers of a number of facts that none of us can deny. We can't kill this technology. We can only criminalize it. We're not going to stop our kids from being creative in the way at least I was not creative growing up. We can only drive that creativity underground. We're not going to make them passive. We can only make them, quote, pirates. And the question we need to ask is that any good? Our kids live in this age of prohibitions, constantly living their life, in all sorts of contexts of their life, against the law. And that experience is deeply corrosive and deeply corrupting of the rule of law in a democracy. And we need to get politicians to focus on that cost as much as they want to focus on the cost to the recording industry.